So what's your name again?
Ajapati.
So as Ajapati Prabhu said, I have spent a lot of my life working with kids. And so I end up reading a lot of children's books. In fact, what I'm in New Zealand for now is to write children's books, among other things. And one story that we read to kids is about a cat who thinks he's a duck. So somehow or other, this cat was abandoned by his mother as a little kitten and was adopted by some ducks and follows the ducks around, sometimes follows the ducks into the water and tries to eat duck food. But of course, cats don't generally like water very much, and the cat wasn't very good at swimming, and you know, it was sort of awkward, and cats don't eat duck food very well. So the cat was really suffering. So in order for the cat to be happy, the cat had to figure out that it was a cat. Right? Typical children's book. At the end of the book, the cat figures out, oh, I'm a cat. So in order to be happy, we have to have some idea of who we are. If we think that we're something other than who we are, then we're going to be hanging out with the wrong family and eating the wrong food and living in the wrong environment and doing the wrong things, and we're going to get sick, just like that poor little cat. So one of the first things that we start out with in considering how to find real happiness is asking, who am I? Who's the real me? So we're going to look at a definition of who ourselves is and some evidence for who we are. Think about what our nature is. And for those of you who brought some writing implements, if you'd like to, you can take one and pass it out over here. And you can take one and pass it out over here. And you can take some and pass it out. There. And you even have pens. Oh, my God. They're really organized. Look at that. Okay.
Should I pass these around now?
Yeah, that would be a good idea. So first we're going to look at what is the definition of a soul, or what do we mean by I'm a soul? In most religions and philosophies of the world, they talk about that you have a soul, whereas the Vedic scriptures teach us that we're not a body that has a soul, we're a soul that has a body. So what is a soul? Well, to understand what a soul is, we have to think of what is the difference between something that's alive and something that's not alive. All right? Can somebody tell me what's the difference between something that's alive and something that's not alive? Yes?
Something that is alive is consciousness.
It has consciousness. That's how I can tell that my computer isn't alive. It never protests. Stop, turn me off now! It never protests. It doesn't have any awareness. It can imitate some of the behaviors of awareness. You can program a computer to say, I see through the window. But it doesn't have any symptoms of awareness. Okay, what else is the difference between life and matter?
Desire.
That's very interesting that you say that, because Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. But really, the most essential element of life is not thinking, but desire or emotion. If you think about some very undeveloped life forms, say amoebas, they don't have much thought processes, one would assume. But they certainly have desire. They have desire to live, they have desire to eat. And those sort of things are not manifest in something that's matter. This instrument here doesn't manifest any kind of desires for anything. Whereas even a little ant, if you move it, it will go in another way. So actually the most essential feature of life is desire. Thank you. Some other differences between life and matter. Yes?
It changes.
Yeah, now of course, matter does change. matter does deteriorate with time. So we do to see some changes in matter, but the changes in matter in life are somewhat different. Living things grow and reproduce, so they have that kind of change, which matter doesn't. Nothing that's matter reproduces itself, you know, or there, it does deteriorate with time. Some other? Yes?
Living thing wants relationship?
Yeah, that practically speaking, all living things, again, even very primitive living things, have some sort of relationships. You know, it may be very, very small if we're looking at some of the plants and the germs and like that. Their relationships may be very undeveloped, but matter has no relationships. There's no exchange, and it comes back again to desire. There's no emotional exchange. By relationships, we mean there's some emotion. I mean, even animals display a great deal of emotion. Even, you know, creatures like mice, they'll cry if an owl takes their babies away. You know, they have some sense of relationships. So the first thing that we look at is saying, all right, well, it seems that all these descriptions of soul apply to me, that I must be something that's not material. You know, I have desire, I have consciousness. I go through some kind. I have some. Well, we were saying about change, but also there's some sort of consistency to life. Even though I've been through so many changes, I still have a sense of continuing identity, which doesn't really happen with matter. You know, this was. Well, what was this before it was a musical instrument? It was a what? It was a tree. What was it before it was a tree? A seed. Okay. And what else before that? What made up the body of the tree? Where did the body of the tree come from? Earth and?
Sunlight.
And sunlight, primarily sunlight. Sunlight, earth, and? One more thing.
Water.
So it's changed its identity completely. Sunlight and earth and water transformed into a tree, which is transformed into this, and this can be transformed into? Fire. Ash. Right? Dirt. Table, another piece of something. So its basic identity changes quite radically. Whereas I have a sense of continuing identity, even though I've been through so many changes. Now, I don't have exactly the same identity I had when I was 4, but I'm the same person. I'm not a different kind of thing. I mean, I can say, well, then I was a little kid, and now I'm a grandma. But I still have a sense of being me. I don't have a sense of becoming something different. Whereas we say that intrinsically, you know, water and earth is something intrinsically different from a musical instrument. Does that make some sense? So it seems that my identity is much more rooted in something that's alive than in something that's matter. But if we examine this body, I mean, in one sense, this body is made up of all sorts of cells. So it's a conglomeration of living beings. But really, the body operates like a machine. The body itself doesn't have any consciousness. The body itself doesn't have any desires, actually. How do we know that? Because when a person dies, the body doesn't have any consciousness or desires. A dead body doesn't get hungry. But all the little cells that made up the body are still living for some time. You know, if you're with somebody when they die, so before they die, they express some desire, and after they die, they don't express any desire. Even though all the little cells in their stomach and their brain and stuff are still living for some time. In fact, the doctors can take the heart and keep it pumping for a while and keep the brain active for a while. And that's how they do transplants. You know, they take a piece of skin and they keep it alive for a while before they transplant it to somebody else. So all the different parts of the body are alive, but yet there's no desire being expressed. One thing that's hard to understand, though, so we can understand a little bit that there's some difference between me and this body. So we can understand that at death, okay, so at right before death, here's somebody, I'm talking to them, they're sitting in the seat next to me in the car, there's an accident, now they're dead and I can't talk to them anymore. So we understand that there's something changed even though the body is there. And it may be a relatively undamaged body. Maybe they just got some big shock and got some blood clot in the brain. And what about a conception? So a conception, what's the body? It's just like a cell, right? But yet the start of the person is there. If you let things take their course, the person becomes manifest. So there's practically no body, but yes, the person is there. And at death, the body's there, but the person's not there. And then just like all of us had somebody like these children at one point, or where's that little baby? She gone out of the room. It was a very little baby. So we've all had a body like that, right? It was only about this big, and our mother could carry us around in one arm. And where's that body? It's not just like, well, it grew. I don't look like a big baby, I hope. But it's radically changed. And yet I have the same sense of identity. So in all these ways, we can understand that there must be some difference between myself and the body. Okay, what about the mind? Well, you know, that's changed too. I don't have the same mind I had when I was 1 month old or 2 years old or 4 years old or even 12 years old. I think quite differently than I did then, quite differently. Now, my mental processes have changed dramatically, and yet I have a sense of being the same person. So is there any kind of evidence for the fact that we're different from both the mind and the body? Well, as we said, there's consciousness. That consciousness is something different from the body or even from the brain. Nobody can explain where is there consciousness in the brain. Is it just like a conglomeration of all the different cells? Then as we were saying, that at death, the person's not there. You know, it's quite interesting if you've ever... Who's ever seen any kind of living creature die? Who's ever been there when some living creature died? And not like a bug. Okay. So you can see a difference. There's a story I read about this man who had it as his job to trap predator animals in the American West that were attacking cows and sheep. And he mostly like coyotes and wolves, things like that. And he'd set up the traps and he'd go there. And usually the animal was already dead when he came to collect the traps. And one day he was taking his 10-year-old son with him, and they came upon a trap where the coyote was still alive. And as they opened up the trap, the coyote died. And the little boy looked at his father and he said, "Daddy, why did the light go out of his eyes?" I mean, you see a dramatic change that happens between life and death. Then there's out-of-body experiences. So I'm sure we've all heard about people, they're on the operating table, you know, their heart flatlines, their brain waves flatline, and then after 10, 15 minutes, they come back to life, and while they were dead, they had an experience of leaving their body and sometimes hovering by the ceiling. Sometimes they'll be able to see a sticker on the top of the light. You know, they'll be able to see things that they couldn't possibly have seen from lying on the table. Sometimes they'll float to the next room and they'll hear conversations in the next room and they'll come back and say, "Oh, the doctors were having this conversation in the next operating room." And there's too many stories like this from too many people that have been verified to just write it off as something, you know, something that's happening in the brain. What kind of thing happening in a flatline brain could allow you to read the stickers on the tops of the light bulbs when you're lying on the operating table? So there must be something different between ourselves and the body. And then, of course, there are people who can remember their past lives. And some of those cases, again, have been verified. If they're not remembrance of past lives, there's certainly something that's inexplicable by saying that all we are is this body and this brain. And people say, "Yes, I remember being there, I was married to this person, I lived in this house," and they go and verify these sort of experiences. And there are many other empirical evidences. And someone can say, "Well, that's not proof." But then we'd have to say, "Well, what is there any such thing for anything as proof? Can you prove anything?" Do you know, with empirical knowledge, all you can do is say that so far we haven't found it to be false. So far, everyone that puts a pot of water on a heat source, the water boils. But we don't know. Maybe sometime it won't. And that's what happens to scientific theories, you know. They're true, they're true, they're true. And somebody comes up with some instance where they're not true anymore and they change their whole theory and they start all over again. You can never say, "Well, we know this for sure through empiricism." That's not possible. Can you ever prove something, therefore, Is it possible? So there's certain evidence that may prove something to me or to you or to you, but someone else might not accept that as proof. So we can say evidence, but proof is rather difficult. Proof is an individual thing. So there's plenty of evidence that the living being has some existence that's separate from this body and mind. And I'd say we also have some personal experience that every once in a while we ask ourselves, is this all there is to life? Is this it? You know, okay, I get a good education, I get a good job, I find a good spouse, and I have wonderful children who get good educations and good jobs and find good spouses, and, you know, I get a nice sofa and a big flat screen TV, and then I get old and I get put in a nursing home and my kids come visit me once a month and I die. I'm like, that's it? Maybe on the way I do some good for the world, you know, I feed some starving kids or I save elephants in Africa or something like that, which doesn't last. Or I build some big building or some big institution which after 1,000 years has crumbled into dust, and maybe I get my name in the obituaries if I'm really, really big. My father got a whole column in the New York Times obituary when he died. But is that it? That's it, right? You know, on your gravestone, maybe it says, you know, that you discovered some cure for some disease. And every once in a while we think, is that it? That's it? So our other evidence is that we are not satisfied with what's going on here. I mean, who wants to die? You can say, well, some people want to die. There are people who commit suicide. Okay, but you go to one of them and say, you know, I'll solve all your problems. Would they commit suicide? If you could guarantee them, you'd solve all their problems. So nobody wants to die. But funny thing, we're in a world where everybody dies. So how is it that we don't want to die and we're in a world where everybody dies? Not only do we not want to die, but we want to be young and healthy forever. We don't want to, like, live forever as some 500-year-old person, you know, in a wheelchair. We don't want that. We want to be young and vibrant. But we're in a world where that doesn't happen. You know, we're talking about gray hairs. Does anybody dye their hair gray? Do they sell that in this shop, you know, gray hair dye? Does anyone go to the plastic surgeon to get wrinkles? So why is it that nobody wants something in a world where everybody gets it? Pretty strange, isn't it? And we all want to be happy. I mean, a scientist called this the pleasure principle, that every living being is searching for happiness. And what kind of happiness would we like? We'd like the kind of happiness where, well, what kind of happiness would we like? Can anyone describe what kind of happiness we would like?
Permanent
happiness. All right. What else would we like it to be? Comfortable. Okay. What other kind of happiness would we like?
Abundant.
Abundant. Yeah.
Increasing.
Is that what we get? Okay. Who here has had 24 hours of, materially speaking, of unlimited increasing happiness? Not even 24 hours. Wow. What does it speak of, a week or a month? I mean, have we gone a whole month with no suffering of any kind, not even any anxiety? Anybody? It's pretty bad, huh? But that's not what we want. You know, I read this article, true story, about this teenager who worked in an ice cream parlor. And the perk was that he got to eat ice cream free for breakfast, lunch, and dinner as much as he wanted. And being a teenager, he did that. And he ate ice cream for breakfast, and ice cream for lunch, and ice cream for dinner, and ice cream for breakfast, and ice cream for lunch, and ice cream for dinner, and ice cream for breakfast, and ice cream for lunch, and ice cream for dinner. And even sometimes he'd feel nauseated, and he'd force himself to eat the ice cream. And he worked there for 3 years. So by the end of the 3 years, he'd actually start to vomit if he even smelled ice cream. And gradually, he couldn't eat any sugar at all. The rest of his life, he couldn't go anywhere near sugar. And that's the problem with material enjoyment. Right? You get it and it gets old, right? And then you think, where's the kick? you know, okay, I guess I got to try a new kind of ice cream, or I need a new partner, or something, you know, because the kick's gone after all. Doesn't that happen? The only way you can keep having a kick is you have to get away from it for a while. You know, okay, I'll only eat this food once a week, or you have to have times when you stay away from it. In Sanskrit, that's called bhogatyaga. In order to enjoy, you have to have some time when you renounce it. You can't just keep enjoying the same thing. It just, there's nothing there anymore. And then in order to enjoy anything, we have to have a feeling of suffering first. Can you enjoy eating when you're full? No. And when you're really hungry, you know how whatever you eat tastes really good at the beginning of the meal, by the end of the meal, the same thing just doesn't taste so good anymore? Can you enjoy sleeping if you're not tired? That's a punishment for a kid, you know. Go to your bed. But I'm not tired. The more tired you are, the more you enjoy sleeping. The more hungry you are, the more you enjoy eating. Right? Why do people buy pornography? They want to increase their desire. Unless they increase their, the more they increase the suffering of their desire, the more pleasure they can get. With no desires, no pleasure. But that need is painful, isn't it? To be hungry, to be lusty, to be tired. It's painful. But without that pain, there's no pleasure. All right, so we have to have initial pain in order to get any pleasure. Then we have to have periods where we're not having that pleasure in order for the pleasure still to have any kick. And even then, the pleasure tends to decrease. Oh, wait a minute. We all want unlimited, increasing, permanent pleasure that's comfortable, that doesn't have any associated pain with it. But do we get that? We don't get that. All right. Well, that ought to tell us that we're in the wrong place. Just like in a desert, I just spent some time in a desert. I spent about a month in a desert. So in the desert, there are creatures who don't need to drink water. Did you know that? Yeah. They can get all their water by eating plants and stuff. They never need to drink water. So they don't feel thirsty. But if we go to a desert, we will feel thirsty because our bodies are made to drink water. So if we were just material, if we were just this body, then we'd be perfectly satisfied in a world that's painful, where all the pleasure is mixed up with pain, where we get old, where we die. It wouldn't bother us. That would be our environment. That would be what we were meant for. The fact that none of us, not one, I mean, it's not just one or two quirky people who'd like unlimited, ever-increasing happiness and they'd like to live and be happy and healthy and young. And everybody else is just satisfied with things. But everybody feels like that. So that says we have a different nature. We're in a place that's out of our nature. Just like if we were in a desert, we'd be out of our environment. So we can understand a little bit of what our nature is. Our nature must be, the thing we're hankering for is indicative of what our nature is. Our nature is to be always joyful and unlimitedly joyful, to be always alive, to be full of life, to have desires, to have, as you were saying, relationships, activities. These are all the symptoms of life. We're also seeking after knowledge. Can you ever know everything in this world? They say the more you know, the more you don't know, right? The people who get you get a PhD, all that means is that you know a lot about a little tiny bit of knowledge. But we're all seeking after knowledge. So this gives us some indication of what is our actual nature. Our actual nature is we want to know, we want to be happy, we want to have relationships, we want to live, we want to be full of vitality, we want to be full of energy. Right? Isn't this what we all want? So this is something of the nature of the soul. Another thing we can understand is that the soul is very individual. Actually, this whole world is full of individuality. How is it that no two snowflakes are ever alike? What an amazing world. Even this body, you'll never find two people with the same thumbprints, the same DNA. And this whole creation seems to be one of uniqueness and individuality and not sameness. And we all like the fact that we're individuals, don't we? It's sort of distressing to find somebody else with exactly your name. That happened to me once on Google. you know, I found out there were like 30 other people in my same state with my same name. It was a little disconcerting. It's like, wait a minute, who am I? We want to have a sense of being a separate person. We don't want to be just part of a crowd, just a number. So we have this individuality. And what we learn from the Vedas is that we're also part of God. That's also an urge that we have, to be part of something greater than ourselves. We want to be part of a family. We want to be part of a nation. We want to be part of a football team. You know, people are watching the football team on the field and they go, "We won! What did you have to do with it? You're sitting in the stands." You know, but people are identifying with their team. So that urge to identify with the whole of which we're a part, we identify with maybe our employer, our university, right? Our country. And we tend to think that if we please that whole, then we'll also be pleased. If I work for my team, if I work for my school, if I work for my employer, if I work for my family, if I work for my country, that will also benefit me. That's also part of our nature. And there is a whole of which we're a part, and that whole is a supreme spirit, which is God. Because we find when we serve these other kinds of wholes, we never feel fully satisfied, do we? We always end up being disappointed. I gave my life to my company, and then they fired me right before they would have to give me my pension. You know, gave my life to my family, and then my spouse divorced me, or I got in a fight with my uncle, and the family got torn in two, or something. And people become disappointed. I gave my life to my country, and I went off to war for my country, sacrificed my left arm and my right leg, and came back in a wheelchair, and they won't even give me medical care. This kind of thing happens all the time. Another part of the nature of the soul is that we have free will. So I'm going to make a deal with anybody who's a taker for this. I'm going to move into your house. I'm going to bring a gun with me. And I'm going to keep the gun pointed at your head. And I'm going to make you do the right thing. I'm going to make you do only good things all day long. Anybody agree to this? You agree to this? All right, we'll try it for a day. No, 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 no. I want to know if you actually agree, not if you think you ought to agree. No, you wouldn't like that. Do we all want the freedom to do things that we know are wrong? Isn't that interesting? All of us want the freedom to do things that we know are wrong. We want the freedom to do things that are against our own ideals, don't we? Anybody want to be forced to live up to their ideals at gunpoint? Wouldn't be very pleasant, would it? I guess our nature is to have free will. How much do we want it? In fact, one of the biggest thrills of doing something wrong is just that sense of, oh, I free will, I can do something wrong if I want to. Because things that are wrong don't have intrinsic enjoyment. That's the definition of something that's wrong, in fact. How do you know something's wrong? There's no inherent enjoyment in the thing. Anything that's right, right means it's connected with God, and if it's connected with God, who's the source of all pleasure, because if we're pleasure-seeking or part of Him, He must be full of pleasure. So anything that's right means it's a source of that unlimited, never-ending joy. And anything that's wrong or sinful means it's something that causes pain. So why do people do things that are sinful? The kick we get out of it is, oh, I'm an independent living being. Huh? I can just do something. I have free will. So that's very much a part of our nature, to have free will, to strongly resist any kind of force. In fact, the harder we're forced, the more we resist. If not externally, then at least in our mind. Right? One of the things that we're most afraid of is being forced, being put into some situation where we'll lose our ability to determine our own future. I mean, from the time a child's about 13 months old, they're strongly exhibiting their free will. The parents think, what happened to my kid? Must be the bad influence of the other children. The other thing that we have as the nature of the soul is that we tend to serve others. If we examine our life, we'll see that we're always doing something for somebody other than just ourselves. At least we're serving our body and our body's demands. We're serving our body, we're serving our mind, we're serving our friends, our family, our country. As I was saying, we like to think of a whole of which we're a part, and we tend to do service. If we don't have anybody to serve, we'll get a pet just so we can serve them. Yeah? Because we feel empty without somebody to serve. People feel much more fulfilled even serving others than just trying to serve their own body and mind. It's a funny thing, isn't it? And it's not really explained with logic. How do you explain that with logic? And if you had $20 and you spent it on something for yourself, some nice new thing that you want, or you use that $20 to buy a gift for someone you really love, think for a minute about someone you really have affection for. Hopefully everybody's got at least somebody. Or someone you had affection for if you don't have anybody now. Maybe your mother, sister, brother, child, or somebody. Animal even. So what would be more satisfying, to spend that $20 to buy something for the living being for whom you have affection, or to spend that money on yourself? Interesting, isn't it? The level of satisfaction is higher when I give something to somebody else. So that tells us also that the nature of life is to serve. All right, so here I am, I'm a soul, and my nature is to serve, to be an individual with free will, to always be happy, to be full of knowledge, to live forever, full of vitality. And what am I in? All right, I'm in this world and in this body that just doesn't seem to match. So what relationship do I have with this body? Well, first of all, although I tend to be very fond of this body because I'm living in it, it's actually pretty disgusting. I mean, if we were to take all the elements of the body and make them in a pile right here, everybody would throw up. Okay. Just a pile of hair here. You know, let's take the nicest parts of the body, the hair, eyeballs. Wow, it's really disgusting. I just speak of the rest of the body, you know, a vat of blood and a liver and nice piles of skin and a bunch of bones and although it's repulsive, why do we find it attractive? Interesting. So what's really attractive about the body? Why is something that has an inherently repulsive nature, why is it attractive? What makes it attractive? That the soul's in there, that the life's in there. As soon as the soul's gone, it's not attractive anymore. Is it? Nobody's very attracted to a dead body. So where's something like the tenants in this body? We're not exactly the owner. How do we know we're not the owner? How do you know that you're a tenant and not an owner? What's the proof that you're a tenant and not an owner?
You pay rent.
You pay rent, but you might pay a mortgage as an owner, and it might be pretty hard to distinguish a mortgage from rent. You can get kicked out. Just happened to my daughter and her family recently. They had a nice place in India, and they're not too much into laws and order there, for those of you who've been there. It's a wild place. Anyway, so one day the landlord came and he said, I want to rent this place to somebody else. You have a week to leave. Hey, if you're the owner, who can do that? Of course, even if you're the owner, there is somebody who can throw you out. I don't know if they can do that here in New Zealand, but they can sure do it in America. Who can throw you out even if you're the owner?
Government.
The government. Yeah. They can say, we want to put a new road through here. Now, usually, they'll, at least in America, they have to compensate you according to the Constitution. They have to pay you the value of your place, which they may not pay the full market value of your place. So even if you're the so-called owner, you can be kicked out. Can we be kicked out of this body? Do we have any say as to when we're going to get kicked out or how we're going to get kicked out? I don't think so.
A little bit,
I don't know. We live right by the ocean here. Has there ever been any tsunamis in New Zealand? Could be. Must have stopped there from being one. Could have one. Right? In Indonesia, they hadn't had one for 500 years. You think anybody was thinking that day they were going to get kicked out of their body? I don't think so. We could be sitting here and then all of us kicked out at once. We have no say in that at all. When you speak of individually, you could fall down the stairs and hit your head, get in a car accident, get hit by a car, so many things. You don't have any control over that. It can happen at any time. So I don't think we're the owner. I think we're a tenant. I think we're a tenant, and I think our landlord can throw us out at any time, with or without warning. Maybe we'll get warning, and maybe we won't. All right, and we were talking about how we try unsuccessfully to find happiness in this bodily existence. It doesn't work very well. Now, another thing that we'll notice is that there's all different kinds of bodies here, right? Each of us have a somewhat different kind of body. Why is that? Why do we each have a different kind of body? How come we don't just all have the same body? And not only do we each have different kinds of bodies, but as we've been defining life, so that would mean that all those trees out there and this plant here, this is also a soul inside a body. It's got a different kind of body. And I'm sure there's all kinds of little bodies in this fabric that we can't see. And that means that there's a soul in each of those different bodies. Why are there all different kinds of bodies? Where do they come from? Well, why are there different kinds of apartments or flats? You probably call them flats here, right? Your British terminology. Why are there different flats? Why are some bigger and some smaller and some painted like this? It's got all this red in here, red curtains. Red and black. Interesting. And other places we've painted blue or green or something like that. Different parts of the town. Why? Yeah, different needs and different tastes. And different something else. A different ability to pay rent. Okay? My taste I may have a taste for some place a lot better than I can afford. Sometimes I may have a need for a place that's better than I can afford. Some people have to live in places that don't really suit their needs. You know, they got 7 kids and they only have 1 bedroom. So the body is the same way. We have this particular body because of our needs, our tastes, and our ability to pay. So ability to pay, we're not going to get into a whole discussion of that today, but that relates to our activities in this world. How pious our activities are, how sinful our activities are. Basically, the more we do activities that are in line with our real nature, the more we get a body that's in line with our real nature, and the more we do activities that are opposed to our real nature, the more we get a body that's in opposition to our real nature. Is pretty simple. So the more I do activities that are like that of the soul, the closer and closer and closer my body gets to the actual form of the soul. And the more I do activities that are opposed to the nature of the soul, the more that I get a form that's opposed to the nature of the soul. And you can call these things like piety and sin, but I don't know, the word sin to me kind of gives out this person who says, these are our rules and don't follow them, you're sinful, you know, and I don't really relate to that very well. But sin is a pretty simple thing. Sin is like, if instead of drinking this water, if I try to eat the cup, then I suffer because it's not in accord with the nature of my body. So if I do things that are out of harmony with who I am, if I do things that are out of harmony with the truth of the universe, then I suffer. But I'm also getting what I want. Just like I was at the Woodstock Festival in Poland a little while ago. And we were going through the festival singing Hare Krishna, and we went past this group of young people who were playing, I can't call it music. And it wasn't even noise. It sounded like animals growling. It's like, what in the world? It sounded like wolves. And they were all, you know, dancing to this stuff. So very peculiar. So that's what they want. They want a wolf body or a dog body. They don't really want a human body. So they're having activities that are in opposition to their spiritual nature because that's their desires, that's their taste. They have a taste for something like that. Or they're sometimes they're making their bodies look very fearsome. You've seen people who do that kind of thing? They make their bodies, they make themselves look like monsters the way they do their hair and their jewelry and their makeup, they actually look like monsters. So they're saying, I would like to have a monster apartment. I'd like to live in a monster body. And the way everything's set up by Krishna, people get what they want. He's like kind of a very overindulgent father. Whatever you want, you get. So this accounts for the different kinds of bodies. And then in each body, we're again expressing our tastes and we're accumulating our karmic cash flow. And then again, we get a body according to our tastes and our payment. So of all these different kinds of bodies, a human body or above, there are higher bodies in other parts of the universe, are the best for, again, remembering that we're a soul. When you're in a body lower than human being, those bodies are facilities for forgetting that you're a soul. That's why you have those bodies, because you want to forget that you're a soul. You want to look for happiness and knowledge and life in matter. So this body has that unique ability. It's about the only unique ability that we have, really. You know, some bodies have the ability to see things from a great distance or smell things, but we have the ability to say, who am I anyway? And why am I not happy here? How come it's just not really working out? Is this all there is? There's got to be something more. Once we ask those questions and we start to understand that we're a soul, then we come to a very fundamental question. Just like the cat who thought he was a duck, in order to understand he was a cat, he had to hang out with other cats and eat real cat food. If we want to understand that we're a soul and function on the spiritual platform and find our unlimited, ever-expanding happiness and eternal life full of vitality, then what we have to do is engage in activities of the soul. Whatever activities we do, that would be what develops. If we simply do activities related to the body and mind, if we're only feeding the body and mind, then again we'll be drawn to another body and mind in this world. What we want to do is feed the soul. I mean, if we think about it, okay, what do I do all day? What do I do for me? Okay, I do all kinds of things for the body. I sleep, I bathe, I hope you all bathe. I brush my teeth, I brush my hair, I put on clothes, I eat, I earn a livelihood, I clean my place, do my laundry. All right, that's all for the body. Then I do some things for the mind. I study, I read some things, I do some things that are mentally stimulating, have some nice discussions with my friends. Okay, so I've been feeding my body, I've been feeding my mind, but if I understand that I'm not the body and I'm not the mind, my question is, how much time do I spend feeding me? What am I doing to develop me? Because I also, as a soul, have a spiritual form. A soul is not just some ethereal concept of, well, I'm just happy and full of knowledge and living forever. But as you're saying, the soul has relationships and is a part of God. I have my own spiritual form. That spiritual form is now sleeping because I've stopped engaging in spiritual activities. Kind of, you can imagine a plant that could go back into its seed. It's something like that. So we have a spiritual body that's kind of gone back into a dormant, seed-like state. So what we want to do is we want to reawaken that form. That is our eternal form. And that form is very beautiful. It's ever youthful. It is spiritual energy. It has an eternal relationship with God, full of love, full of variety, based on free will. So how much time do I spend feeding that? So the Vedic scriptures teach us a process for feeding the soul, for having activities that have to do with the soul. Oh, and there's one really nice thing about that. That's actually really astonishing, that when you start engaging in those activities that feed the soul, it acts something like a fire. And just like if you have a fire, you put a pot on the fire, the pot also gets hot, right? So what happens is that when you start doing the activities that feed the soul, then gradually all of the activities you do to take care of the body and mind start also to act like fire. They also start becoming spiritualized, so that there becomes no separation between material and spiritual. Everything becomes spiritual. So these are the questions to ask ourselves as human beings. If I can understand that I'm something other than this body and I have someplace other than this world, how much of my energy, how much of my anxiety, how much of my desires, how much of my thought, how much of my day is going to that? How much am I doing for that? You know, every day when we go to sleep, maybe every day, or maybe some of you do it every week, maybe some of you never do it. But hopefully we periodically evaluate ourselves. What was my day like today? Did I have a good day? You know, I know somebody who evaluates their day by how much money they made. If I made a lot of money, it was a good day, he says. So we all have some means of evaluating ourselves. But our primary one should be, what am I doing for the real me? How much am I doing for myself? How much am I focused on the soul? Or how much am I just caught up in the things of the world? So we have a few minutes, right? For questions, comments, additions, subtractions. Yes. How do plants show consciousness? Anybody know?
Grow up instead of the way you grow.
They grow up instead of grow down?
Both ways.
They go both ways.
Yeah.
But how else do they show consciousness?
They breathe.
Do you know that they respond to music?
Mm-hmm.
They even know the plants respond to music? There's been a lot of experiments. Sorry for those of you who attach this kind of music, but you know, that like heavy metal music, you put some plants with heavy metal and you put some plants with like Mozart, and the plants with heavy metal just, you know, wither up, and the plants exposed to Mozart bloom. So there's been many experiments done like this in many different cultures and circumstances with plants.
Also, if they're spoken to nicely, they grow more.
They do. Again, there's been the former Soviet Union, the government did a whole lot of experiments with shall we say, supernatural type stuff, you know, with extrasensory perception stuff, subtle paranormal stuff, because they wanted to use it for military purposes. And one of the things they did was with plants. And they found that plants were affected by a person walking in the room thinking, I'm going to uproot that plant, even if they didn't say anything. That if they hooked up the plants to different sensors, the plants would register a feeling of anxiety. Pretty interesting. Just by somebody thinking that, just walking in the room thinking, I'd like to uproot that plant, and the plant goes into a panic state. How do they do that? They can also change course. If a plant's growing, it can sometimes grow like around a wall and that kind of thing. The consciousness they exhibit is very low. Again, that's because of desire. Some people like to have very low consciousness. Some people want to be like vegetables, right? Some people even take chemicals to make themselves like practically like vegetables. They want to be a vegetable. So as I said, God is a very indulgent father, and he says, okay, you want to be a vegetable? Have a vegetable body. There you go. Be practically unconscious. Anybody else? Yes.
Just a question on how much that we do is based on free will and how much is based on like past activities, because if everything is based on what we do and on our actions, so how much that we're doing in this life is based on stuff that's just like reaction, and how much is our free will?
Very good question. So just like I flew here to Auckland, so now all the places I can go have to start here. Like I just flew here from Dubai. I can't start from Dubai anymore. I've got to start from Auckland. And there's only so many flights that go from Auckland to other places. So because of my choice to come to Auckland, that then limits the choice that I make from here. So then I can choose to go to Sydney. Then once I go to Sydney, then I have to start from Sydney. So even if you're saying things are based on our past activities, that's all our free will. By the exhibition of our free will, we make choices which then restrict our free will. Everybody does that. You decide by your free will to go here instead of there, and then you have to start from here. Does that make sense?
So if we have, the example of apartment, that because we only have a limited amount of, say, karmic reaction, we only have a desire, well, we have lots of desires, but because of our past karma, we can only afford a specific type of arrangement.
At that time. All right, but let's say that by your past activities, by your past desires, our real desires are manifest in our behavior. Desire isn't just like a wish. Oh, I wish I could have $1 million. If you really desire to have $1 million, you do something. You don't just sit around staring at the wall thinking, I wish I had that. But if you have some intense desire for something that you can't afford right now, what the Lord will do, He's in your heart, is He'll give you instructions as to how to fulfill that desire, which then you can be free to follow or not. But He'll give you instructions as to how to accumulate the karmic balance so that you can fulfill that desire. Does that make sense to you? So you may not be able to do that in this life. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. That depends where you're starting from. Just like if you go to a university, you say, I want to become an engineer, then they'll tell you what courses to take to be an engineer. So the soul is expressing its desires, and then the Lord within the heart is giving directions. Okay, if you want that, you need to do this and this and this. And the Lord will give you opportunities to do those things, which will enable you to get the balance to achieve those desires.
And if you don't have the karma from your past, is it still possible?
Well, yeah, but it may take some time. If I want something that I can afford now, then I can just buy it now. So if you really want something and you have the karma for it now, then you can get it now. But if you really want something that you can't afford right now, then what Krishna will give you instruction, which again, you can follow or not. It's not like you'll be forced to follow. But He'll give you opportunities. Do this activity, talk to this person, go here, do this. And if you do those things, then you'll gradually accumulate the karma to get what you want. Now, that may not happen in this life. It depends where you're starting from. If you're starting from a dollar, you know, it may take you a few lifetimes to accumulate the karmic credit to get your desire. But you will get all of your, just anything you desire really strongly, and anything you work for in the proper way, you will get. And that's true spiritually too. If we really want to develop our spiritual body, if that's our real desire, then Krishna in the heart, who wants us to do that, because He wants us to be really happy. He doesn't want us to have this really shoddy reflection of happiness. He'll also give you guidance. Talk to these people, do this thing, go here. Again, you can do it or not. But He'll give you the guidance how to achieve that desire. But another answer to your question also is, you know, it depends on the particular case. I mean, just speaking materially, just like some crimes have a set punishment that the judge can't change. You know, sometimes there's a mandated sentence. The judge has to give you 15 years in jail and that's it. And other crimes, the judge can give you 15 years in jail or 5 years of community service or 2 years probation. The judge has some leeway. So depending on what we've done, we may be more or less tied to our karma. So some of us here have more freedom in this life than others, depending on the nature of the things that we've done in the past. So some things are set. That can be changed spiritually, but speaking materially, there are some things that are just set, that if all you're doing is acting materially, you're just going to go through them and that's it, if you did certain kinds of activities. And other things, there's some adjustment. You can take it this way, or you can take it that way, you can take it the other way. You can play with it to some extent. And most of us have some mixture of those. Some people have lives that are very much destined by their past activities, and other people have lives that are much more free. So that's part of the reaction, not just what you're getting, but how much choice you have in this particular lifetime. Now, that can be changed once we put ourselves on the direct guidance of Krishna, once we put ourselves directly under the supervision of God. And that's something like the school that I used to run was very individualized. So we would test each child and we would place them sometimes at one level in math and one level in English and one level in science. Whereas in a normal school, you just have to be at the same level as everybody else who's your age. It doesn't matter whether you're better or worse than something, just too bad. You know, it's like a factory. You just go in, well, you're 8 years old, okay, here you go with the other 8-year-olds. But I already know this stuff, well, too bad, you're 8, you know, that's it. So when we're just working under the material laws of karma, whatever we do, there's a law, and that's it, and that's what you get. Oh, well. And once you come under the personal supervision of Krishna, then he's looking at your record personally and saying, okay, well, you've already learned this lesson, you know. This was slated for you to go through, but you don't need to go through it anymore. It's not necessary. Or, hey, you say, you know, you really want to get rid of all this material life. Well, you have this lesson you were going to get 200 lifetimes from now, but I think you can handle it now. Let's go for it. You know, so he's going to adjust things like that. You're under personal supervision. Yes?
What is the method of feeding the soul you talked about?
Oh, thank you. So just like if we're going to do things for the body and mind, we tend to do things for the whole of which we feel we're a part. Right? So in the same way, if we want to feed the soul, we want to do things for the spiritual whole of which we're a part. And that is, we want to connect again with God. The things of our spirit, what does the soul do? So the soul is engaged in talking about spiritual subject matter. What is the nature of God? What is the nature of the soul? What is God doing? What are his friends doing? Just like materially, we're thinking about, okay, what did I do today? What will I do tomorrow? What is my mother doing? What is my son doing? What is my friend doing? What is this rock star doing? What is this cricket star doing? So spiritually, we think about, what's God doing? What are his friends doing? And there are many descriptions in the scriptures as to what he's doing. In fact, like right now. Seriously. Right now, he's milking the cows. And he has a golden bucket that he's holding between his knees. And he's milking the cow. It's a spiritual cow. It's not a material cow. And she's licking him, and just the taste of God is putting this cow into complete ecstasy. And as he's milking the cow, he has this beautiful decorated silk turban, and he's leaning against the body of the cow, and the turban is kind of tilting to the side a little bit. And many of his loving devotees are watching him and thinking, ah, I want him to come milk the cows at my house. That's what he's doing right now. So one can meditate on what are the activities of the Lord, what are the activities of the great souls. And some of them are manifest in this world. So the scriptures are full of these activities. What did this saintly person do? How did God interact in the life of this saintly person? So we start, we think about those. We read them, we hear them, we talk about them. We meditate on them. We can become absorbed in, instead of becoming absorbed in my name and my form and my activities, materially speaking, I become absorbed in the name and form and activities of the Lord and his associates. And as I do that, gradually, I will wake up to what is my name, my real name, my real form, and my real activities. And then after some time, that will come naturally. That can't be done artificially. After some time, I will be meditating on that. I'll be thinking, oh, what am I going to do for the Lord today? How am I going to be assisting? How am I going to be helping the other residents of the spiritual kingdom? And we can practice that in this world. We can practice that mentality that we make the Lord the center of our home, and we can cook for him, and we can sing for him, and we can do work for him. And we start to associate with other people who are also in that mentality, and we create a little replica of the spiritual world. Now, of course, it's sort of a replica of the free world inside the prison at first. But after some time, as we gradually wake up to who we are, as that, as we kind of water that seed of the plant, then the plant again starts coming out of the seed, and eventually, or something like, when we were children, we played as if we were adults, but it wasn't real, right? So little girls play, oh, I'm going to be the mommy, and you'll be the baby, and, right? Put that sofa over here, and the little boys are taking the fire trucks and going. So in one sense, that isn't real. You know, you're not really being a fireman when you're 5 years old going zoom, zoom with your fire truck. But that's how we prepare for our adult life, isn't it? If you don't get to play properly, you can't be a proper adult. And one day, and this will happen to you guys if it hasn't already happened to you, one day you take out your toys and it just doesn't work anymore. You all remember that? You take out the dolls or the trucks, you know, and you try it, you went, no juice in this anymore. It just doesn't work, you know. And I think I tried it about 4 or 5 times. All right, I'm going to get out my toys, you know. It just didn't work anymore. So we practice like this, making Krishna the center, serving with other people, and eventually you wake up to who you are. Just like eventually if you become an adult and your tastes change and you go, oh, okay, this is what I really want to be. So that will happen. And then one meditates on one's actual eternal spiritual activities. But, you know, our basic things, chanting Hare Krishna, because Krishna is the same as his name, when we say his name, then we, again, relate with him. And as soon as we relate with him, our own spiritual nature starts to develop. And we eat for him and we work for him. Yes?
To continue to develop spiritually, what's the most important thing that we need to do or remember on a daily basis?
We need to be always connected with the Supreme Spirit, who's God. To constantly connect everything with Him. To change the way we interpret our environment. That when I breathe, I think, okay, this air is also Krishna's energy. That's also God's energy. He's also present in this air. I have my breathing remind me of God. When I see the sun, I think, oh, the sun is just a reflection of the effulgence of the Lord. The sun is the eye of the Lord. Just like my eyes, they need to have light go in them to see, but the Lord's eye has light coming out of it. When I'm drinking water, I can think, oh, water is very soft but very strong. In the same way, the Lord is very delicate but very strong. And this nice taste, refreshing taste in the water, that is some indication of the taste of God. So I want to just connect. The word yoga literally means to connect. I want to keep connecting. And a key to how to do this, there's 3 places in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna explains how to connect with him in this world. One is the 7th chapter, one is the 10th chapter, and one is the 15th chapter. And each of these he lists how one can see him in the sunshine, in the moonshine, in all the great things of the world, the most powerful things of the world. So somehow to always be connecting our consciousness with him. So we're helped in doing that by reading about him. It's kind of hard to connect with someone you don't know well. So we can learn. I mean, we're very fortunate that there's scriptures such as Bhagavatam, which tell us, what does God look like? What does he do all day? Who are his friends? Where does he live? What is he like? And that way we can start thinking of him not only in the world, but thinking of him as a person. And certainly to repeat his names. That puts us directly in his presence. And that happens even if we're at a very beginning level of spiritual development. It's a very, very powerful way of reestablishing that connection. And as we reestablish that connection, we then revive our own self. But that's the most important thing to do, to be constantly engaged in yoga, to be constantly making that connection, 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 connection. What is really going on here? What is the reality? If the reality is not that I'm this body and I'm part of this world, what is the reality? Always taking your mind, not your mind, but your emotions back to the source, back to the source, back to the source. Having everything remind you of God and everything connect you with God, and then connecting all of your own actions with God. So how to do that specifically is a whole science, which I can't explain in just 1 or 2 minutes, but at least that's sort of an overview of what is the essential principle of that science of yoga. To reconnect, reconnect, reconnect. I'm already connected. I just have to become alive to it. I have to become aware of it and function on that platform of reality. And as I make the conscious choice to do that again and again and again and again and again, my whole perception starts to change. And I start to find, even in this world, great joy and knowledge and vitality in my real self. Right, so we should stop now, I believe, right? Correct? So thank you very much.
Can you give a big round of applause?